Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, episode 26 of the Create More podcast with the co-founder of Fathom Architects, Justin Nichols. This was another podcast that was recorded just before Christmas, the end of 2020, as part of my big batch of podcasts to keep me tided over until the end of COVID, whenever the bloody finishes. It's a really cool episode. If you're not an architect, this is a lot of like high-level discussion about like what it feels like to start an architecture practice, the excitement of creating a business from scratch. And that's a central theme that comes through all the podcasts. Fathom are a London-based architecture practice. Their studio is over near the Shard, so it makes it very easy for anyone to get there. It was great cycling there because you cannot miss the Shard. So I was in the studio. It was really fun. We talk all about what it's like to start an architecture practice, what it feels like. You have to be, he's now a mentor. He's now runs a company. The kind of highs and lows at the beginning, probably more highs. And the reason I was really interested with Fathom is I feel they're quite unique. I talk about this in the podcast that they're one of the business partners is from a film background, actually. So he brought a lot of the kind of production knowledge and kind of the business side of production for kind of film production into the architecture practice, which I thought was a really interesting blend. And Justin talks all about how they started and where they're going, what the future looks like. I also love all their branding. That's a huge thing for me as well. I love all the graphic side of stuff, so that's really cool. And yeah, I really hope you enjoy it and tune in to the end to hear who's on the next podcast. Thanks, bye. So what do you think of the setup? So I'll give you a little tour, right? So this is a mixing desk and you can have four different inputs, right? And then this is a special thing called a cloud lifter. And what it does is it powers these microphones. And the reason these are so expensive, these are the most expensive microphones you can buy, basically. Not most expensive. You know, like Joe Rogan podcasts and stuff? Do you know, anyway, so no. The biggest podcast all uses. And the reason they're really good is that if you have them really close to your mouth in a couple of inches, so if you want to pull it a little bit closer, there you go. Yeah. So they have like super, like it's really powerful up to this, but then you can't hear any of their kind of any echo. It's got deadening software in there.
Love that shit.
It's really good. It's really good. So
Is this monitor headphones as well?
They are monitor headphones.
They're feeling pretty.
Yeah. I look very Craig David. I sometimes wear them in Teams meetings. So I've got them on to drown out my kids in the background. And then I'm like, because they're not cool headphones.
So got to get a pair of monitor headphones, but there's no point if you're going to listen to music on an iPhone, is it?
You say that. They're very good.
Are they?
They're very good. Okay. You'll just be nodding away.
On Bluetooth?
No, you can't get these on Bluetooth, unfortunately. Yeah. You've got to get these dangly little cables. So, first of all, thank you, Justin, for coming on my podcast.
Pleasure.
Do you know much about my Create More podcast?
Not really.
Not really. Good. So the reason I have selected you as one of my key guests is it's about creative entrepreneurs. And the thing that I'm most interested in is that moment of when someone has a passion or a hobby or creative aspirations and they turn that into their job or their business. And I actually think there's a huge moment that we'll talk about, I'm sure, when you first set something up that's yours and that's your own idea and your own aspiration, and then seeing it growing and all of the challenges and things that come along with it. And so your architecture practice, Fathom, do you know what? How long is it? When did you start?
We started 3 weeks before the Brexit referendum vote. So about 4.5 years ago.
Oh, it's gone really quickly. Again, we were discussing how time is just, we've lost time because of COVID. I think as well, when people say Brexit was that long ago, I'm like, is it really that long ago?
It's been that cloud that's been hovering for that long. Apparently we've sorted.
Apparently, yeah. So
no idea how we've sorted it.
Just lorries backing up. So the thing I was really interested in is, one, full disclosure, we worked together. Well, we never actually did a project together, but we both worked at a previous practice together. Yeah. And we're both no longer at said practice. And I was excited to understand, because I would imagine that, so I've done two series of Create More, and I know a little bit about the kind of demographic of people that listen. Mm-hmm. It's quite a broad range of people. It's actually not just architects. It's quite a lot of other creative people, because the guest list is across a whole different range of different people. So last week, or before Christmas, I interviewed Fred Mills, who's on the B1M. He does the biggest YouTube channel mm-hmm. for construction, which I think is really interesting. And then the week before, I interviewed some guys who 5 years ago decided they wanted to build an e-bike. And now they run a really successful bike manufacturing company just outside kind of Dulwich area. So, and then the other guest lined up, there's like visualization specialists. So all of the things that I think they have in common are ultimately like people who wanted to do something and had the kind of passion and drive to do it on their own. Yeah. And something we were talking about earlier, the way I described our old practice is very much like a warm bath. You know, when you're in a big, big company, all of the systems are in place, but you started your own company. And one of my first questions to you, how long from the time that you thought, I'm going to start my own practice, to actually taking the step of handing in the big notice?
It's a tricky one. And I think probably the honest answer is it's always been there all the way back through to school, actually. And it sort of manifested itself in different moments. The reason why I left Foster's when I was there from college for about 11 years and then left Foster's to help Ken Shuttleworth set up Make Architects. And there was a moment there I was like, I would be, for some reason, I felt being a board director at Foster's was terrifying. I have no idea why, but it was just something in my head. I got on with everybody. I really enjoyed working there. I did speak to someone at that point about setting up a practice, and I thought actually Make would be great, because it would be great to learn how to set up a business, how to run a business, and I hadn't had exposure to that side of things at that point. And then went and did Make, and that went really well, and I stayed there for probably much longer than I thought I would originally, which was great, and you know, some amazing jobs that you know. And it was probably couple of years before I left, I'd say, that I really seriously thought about it. And I think you get to that moment where this has been niggling away in my mind since I was a child. I've got to do something about it soon, and I've found lots of excuses along the way not doing it.
Yeah.
And if I don't do it now, I'm going to be too old, it's gonna be too late. So I think that was, It's a very, very long gestation, if that makes sense.
Because I guess there's a point where you're like, okay, I'm going to do it, and now I have to do a business case and like a plan. I need to work out like cash, like how do I start this? So I think what I was really interested in is that you started with a kind of business partner.
Well, about 2 years before we started, I sat in my father-in-law's basement in Devon one Easter. And I spent 3 days nonstop, apart from a bit of sleep, writing a business plan. And I had a copy of the Financial Times, How to Set Up Your Own Business, and I had a copy of the RBA, How to Set Up a Practice. And I merged what I'd learned from those two books into a business plan. And also the really boring bit of the business plan, which is the most important bit, which is the spreadsheet. And as my business partner, Tom, will tell you, I'm rubbish at spreadsheets. But it enabled me to put a load of stuff on paper that was already crystallized in my mind, because you're sitting there thinking about, oh my God, I don't know how to set up a business. And when you go through that sort of list of things you've got to write down, you suddenly realize that 80% of them are already sorted. So on that day, 5, 6, 7 years ago, it's like, okay, on a studio at London Bridge. And it's like, here we are, you know, 7 years later, sitting in a studio at London Bridge.
So this was always your plan to have an office here?
And, you know, for very selfish reasons, that it's three stops away on the train. But, you know, you've got to have some benefits of balancing the stress of running your own business. And that made it much less overwhelming, because suddenly you realize, okay, so what's this 20%? This last 20% is really about your brand and your, you know, what's your offer? And then you go, okay, so that's the bit we need to think about. But I'm 80% of the way there. And to do that, I think you then need to bring in other people and bounce those ideas.
So the business plan originally was just you, and then you were like, okay, I need some.
Well, it was written by me, but it was never just me, if that makes sense. It's like, it's identifying, okay, I now need to bring, this is a team thing. now we need to create the team. And obviously that plan gets adjusted and tweaked and gets better.
So because you would assume that an architecture practice would be run by another architect, right? So it'd be you just have more and more architects, but Tom's background isn't in architecture, is it?
No. So what I realized doing the spreadsheet is I wasn't very good at doing spreadsheets. and I felt like I was slightly guessing at what the answers might be. So having someone there that had run businesses before was really important. And meant that Jonathan and I could then focus on how we do the architecture, and Tom could focus on making sure the business works properly. And I think that's been a real strength. So on one level, it's about running business, but actually on another level, it's about Tom's background in other creative industries. So he comes from film production, so he's worked with a lot of ad agencies, a lot of advertising and so forth. And I always found the structure of that world much more fluid and much more interesting than the world of architecture that I come from, which is a kind of, you know, two big practices and kind of big machines, if you like.
Yeah.
And it felt that the world was getting much more fluid in the way it worked. So having someone with the experience of setting up teams and running businesses in that way was really helpful. And I think it also helped us communicate that to clients who are, you know, some clients are used to those big environments and feel more comfortable there.
So is when you say teams, you don't mean projects, you mean this office, or does Tom also help?
The team is in a big group of people sitting in an office.
Interesting, because I think there's so many similarities between the storytelling of a good architecture project to film, and I'd imagine once you get to a certain scale, a lot of these big projects across any industry start to have repetition and things. So what I get, the reason I'm fascinated is because it's unusual. I've not heard of someone coming from, I guess, the film industry into an architectural industry. And I'm fascinated about the kind of cross-pollination of industries. Was Tom up for it? Was he like, oh, this is completely out of my comfort zone? Or was he like,
Both. he felt it was a really interesting kind of proposition. And at the same time, I think it's also been quite tricky, and I think, you know, you probably have to ask him, but he's surprised at how slow the industry is to change. And, you know, and I get that from both sides. You know, we deal with a huge amount of money, huge amount of investment in buildings, so you naturally, people have to be cautious either how you invest or how you build, etc. Whereas in film and advertising, things are much quicker and therefore can innovate much quicker. But, you know, I think it's been really interesting having him on board and giving a different view of the world. And that's really helpful for Jonathan and I, putting up a kind of an educated layperson's view of what we're working on.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that looks really interesting, but it's boring. Or it's really boring, even though the story is really interesting. Or why are we doing that? So I think that makes us much sharper.
Yeah, I think the idea that you'd have someone with an outside perspective come and help try and change things. I mean, I guess if we go back to the beginning of when you first started, were there milestones that you were really excited to hit? You know, like, oh, when I get my first paycheck, or as in like the check from a client, or when I move into our first office, were those milestones that you were really excited about, or were they just like, these are just problems I need to solve because the end goal of 5 years away is looming?
Yeah, I think day one was very exciting. I'd been on a long weekend away, so I wasn't quite as fresh as I normally am. And I remember having a meeting with the lawyer about signing off some paperwork and bits and pieces. Oh, hang on, this is really serious now. And this is probably not the right frame of mind to be in to be doing something really serious. And had a phone call by midday from a really good client that I'd worked with before who wanted to do a piece of work. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Is this what the next... By the time we get to Friday, we're going to be huge. And I don't think we had another phone call for about 3 months.
For that first day.
It's a complete roller coaster. And, you know, it's as exciting as it is daunting. And, you know, we've had a tough sort of 12 months, to say the least. And actually, since we started, we've been pushing slightly against the kind of Brexit uncertainty. So I'm hoping soon.
Yeah.
Things might actually start rolling a bit more sort of freely. But yeah, no, it's great. And it's, you know, when you start employing people, it's really fantastic because you're building a team, you're bringing in to that conversation people with different backgrounds and different design cultures. And I find that really fascinating. And balancing that against people who you know and love for years and can work together really fluidly.
Yeah.
And starting to kind of get that mix works really well in terms of the quality of design, but also, you know, the interest of conversation you have around the studio and so forth.
So for people who want to understand the kind of speed of scale, I think I'm fascinated as in the number of people you had here, because I know there's people here who sat at the desk doing their architecture job going, I'd love to start my own practice. And I'm sure the realities are so much more complicated. But you, where was your first office? So did you work from home for a bit, or did you actually just go, let's have a custom space?
So our first office was, we had six desks in Waterman's office over in Borough Market. So they very kindly lent us some space for, and that made a huge difference to the kind of risk of running a practice, and gave us a bit of stability, gives you a bit of credibility as well. So they were very kind and very generous to us for that. So we thank them as always. And I think it's really nice to, you know, support young businesses as they sort of flourish, and something that, you know, coming from a big practice, that's something very easy to do if you're 200 people and you've got six spare desks. It's very hard to do if you're only six people. So that level of generosity, I think, is fantastic. And, you know, we always try and find and think of ways that we can give back to people.
And then, so you're at Waterman's office. You've got was it you and Tom? Was it you? Because I think
it was just Tom and I, and Jonathan came. He resigned the day we started, I think, if I remember that correctly. Yeah, so there's only two or three people there. We've got a few laptops. And then there's that thing of kind of putting the infrastructure together. So there's a sort of people thing, and that's sort of super critical. And we're obviously very kind of top heavy, if you like, but that was deliberate because that enables us to expand, give a really good quality of service. And then the kind of infrastructure element was actually, this is really easy because we can do everything off a laptop.
Yeah.
And we went cloud-based on day one, which every IT consultant I spoke to told me I was mad. And then sure enough, 4 years later, we find ourselves actually that worked out really well. But it makes you much more nimble. And I think businesses setting up now are very different when we started Make about 15 years ago. We were like, we had servers, we had lots of conversations about not having paper filing. And how do we file these weird things called emails? So that the transition in technology in terms of setting a business up in 10 years is huge.
Yeah,
it's very fluid. When we had the first lockdown, we left on Monday night, we carried on working on Tuesday morning. We had two big tender deadlines on the Friday, which we hit. And, you know, the client was like, what, you still carried on? It's like, yeah, it was absolutely fine. Much to our surprise, as much as anybody else's. But I think that forward looking to technology is really important in how you structure a business. Mm. So our business model of bringing in experts and being much looser and more fluid with the team we work with only works actually when you have that technology sitting behind it. It would have been much harder 10 years ago to do what we do today.
Yeah. Because you've I know it's on your website that you've got a kind of spider diagram or whatever type of diagram it's called. And it says like what external consultants you use or people you work with. Cause you work with Atlas, and we've worked with Atlas at Make. And I guess that's another thing that 10 years ago, that kind of working digitally across halfway. For those who don't know, Atlas are kind of, are they Vietnamese CAD company?
Yeah.
And they're, I mean, I worked with them for 2 years when I was at Make on Skyscraper, and they were just insanely good at just doing really good things quickly. And of course you get that kind of 24-hour working model where you can kind of like hand over in the evening and they've kind of done it in the morning. And I thought it was an interesting new change.
Yeah, and it's worth having a look at the diagram on the website. It took ages to do, and I'm not entirely sure it's still right, to try and describe what we were trying to create and now have created. So we have a core team of people. We're generally quite senior, you know, if you look at the sort of the experience and range of the kind of core team. We then have key experts that we bring in there. So we have Lara on interior design. She used to run a team of 35 people at Foster's. And she now works for us. So we could do an office reception to a A- or a B+, where she takes it to an A+ or beyond. We have Adrian Gaynor on laboratory planning, who's amazing, used to run the HAK's lab team. We've worked together for 10 years when we were doing laboratories for Oxford University. And
these are external consultants. These don't work in the office.
There's a bit of a mixture. And to be honest, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And interesting, when you speak to people, they all put themselves in slightly different places in the bubble. And it's kind of like, actually, if you feel most comfortable there, that's fine. and what we're trying to communicate to the outside world is this is about people. It's not about where people sit in the bubble. Mm. And you're employing those people. And that's exactly where that kind of ad agency film production background of Tom's comes from. Is like, okay, we're going to do a film, we're going to do Star Wars. Who are the best people to do Star Wars? And they're probably completely different to, who you choose to do Peaky Blinders, yeah. for example. And that was the thing that really drove my interest in it, is that you get the right people in to do the right job. Interestingly, all the people there, which is something I wanted to communicate early on day one, is we've worked with for years. So Caravan, who do amazing visualization and illustrations for us, we'd worked with for 5 years. Atlas, I think we worked out it was about £350 million worth of construction we'd built with them over years as experience. So these weren't people we just found on the internet. Yeah. These are really kind of nurtured and cherished relationships. And I think when people say, oh, how many people are you? It's like, if you're a big practice, you go, oh, I'm 250 people. But that includes, HR, IT, BIM, visualization, et cetera, et cetera. So part of the point of that model is it shows all those people we work with in and out. And we try and nurture those particular relationships really well so that it becomes a sort of flawless team. The other thing you then got to put together with that is processes. So QA, PI, insurance, etc., has to be created like an umbrella that fits over the top of that, so to make sure there's nothing falling sort of between the cracks.
Yeah, because it's interesting you said like cloud computing has changed a lot. I know that the new practice I work at, Heta, they've just all like so many like apps like Xero and all the like Harvest and timesheets and how automated everything is and how effortlessly simple a lot of this tech is to use now. And it's just like, oh yeah, here's my timesheet, here's my holiday sheet, it's on an app. It's so good. And
it changes very quickly as well, so you can't be too wedded to certain ways of working. And Teams is a really good example where no one had heard of Teams that I've ever met before March, and now that's the only thing we all use.
I cannot believe how much we've all got obsessed. I mean, interesting, like my practice, that we would do a lot of projects in South Korea, so there was, for us, everything was very remote anyway. So actually lockdown didn't make any difference to us. And I'd already been working from home and things. But I'm still fascinated. So I guess from a business point of view, how did you get your first project? How did you, like, you have to pay yourself a wage. Tom wants a wage.
Yeah.
Jonathan's going to want a wage. That's a lot of wages very quickly. And you need fee earning projects, and they need to be proper big projects. How does that all work? Is that pre-existing relationship?
Yeah, so as we mentioned earlier, that first project came in literally as a phone call, probably 4 hours after we started, which is weird and completely unheard of. And then the rest of that is, a huge amount of work in kind of marketing, PR, new business. And obviously most of that is around people you know. So, business is done with people who know you. So, talking to them, working out what their needs are. We spent a lot of time with Dean and Co, who did our branding, who are fantastic at really kind of eking out of us what we were going to be about and are about now. Tom and I sat, I think, upstairs in House of St. Barnabas in Soho Square for probably about 6 months trying to work out what we were about. And I think we got it down to 10 A's, 4 sides. So we gave that to Dean in case, look, we need some help here. So they were fantastic at coming up with a name and really refining that kind of USP and that messaging. And we've just gone back to that actually in the last couple of months and reworked that again with them.
That's my favorite part about the process. I think, the whole point of the podcast, Create More, was kind of like a mantra, just do more stuff for the sake of doing it. But I love coming up with the logo, the branding, the colouring. That was one of the reasons I got my job at Heta. That was the first thing I did, was actually work to redevelop all this stuff. And we got a PR agency in to try and help, you know, try and do this process. It's such a, it's like therapy, isn't it? You're like, I found the whole process fascinating, as long as you're all on the same page. And also, did we, you and Tom kind of, did you develop it together, or is Fathom, would he, I don't know, how does it work? Are you the
figure? We batted around. I think what was really interesting is that Tom, coming from outside of architecture, was a really good mirror for what an architect thought an architect's practice should be about. And it's actually, it shouldn't really be about what an architect thinks it should be about. It should be what, you know, your clients and general public think it should be about. And then obviously as we worked along with that, then Jonathan came in, who we'd already worked together for about 9 years. So it was getting the right answer, I think, was most important. And the collaboration of those three mindsets actually makes it better. Mm. And it is much easier to do when you're starting from nothing than it is when you have a practice and you're trying to rebrand, or you know, the classic one is you're trying to redo a website and suddenly actually unpicks a whole load of issues between partners, directors, or, you know, where's the business going, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it was much easier to do, I think, from scratch.
Because I really think that if, when the branding's done right and the ethos and the thought behind it builds such a strong foundation that you, it answers everyone's questions, or it's always the kind of go-to art, like, why are we doing this? It's because of this reason. And then you come forward. And if everyone's on the same page, I think it's a really powerful tool. And what's your one? Your one's working on sensitive, I can't remember what it is.
Complex projects and sensitive sites. Yeah. And it's, you know, there were two things we sort of recognized that we had a sort of skill in that we brought together, which we thought were two things you wouldn't necessarily bring together. So one is the ability to work on complex projects. And I think that comes from being quite rigorous and logical in our thinking. Probably goes back to Foster days of using the diagram to really kind of flush out problems. And that enables you to do, I don't know, multiple uses stacked up in one building, or building next to a railway line. I was looking at a project the other day that we worked on years ago, and it's like, oh my God, it's by the Victoria Main Line, which we kept 6 metres away, so we didn't have to do any consultation with Network Rail. The columns in the front actually sit in a dock, which is completely open to the Thames. So I was like, oh my God, I never really thought of it like that. And then, oh, by the way, there's a huge, all the sewage from northwest London flows underneath it. And I thought, actually, you don't really get much more complicated than that. And quite often you forget that. So that's been, we had another project where we worked with, we're about a metre away from the Hammersmith tube line. So if you dropped a brick under construction, you get a huge fine, and, you know, and really dangerous. So, you know, on one hand, that works really well. And on the completely other end of the scale is this idea of sort of sensitive sites. So both Jonathan and I studied at Bath. We'd actually lived in a World Heritage Centre World Heritage Site for 4 years each, sadly in different decades. And you have an understanding and a sensibility of working in conservation areas, listed buildings, and we very much see them as a positive attribute rather than a constraint. So it's sort of like 6% positive, 40% tricky, rather than 6% tricky, 40% positive. And once you flip that percentage over, the project flows really well. And I think what's unusual is having the ability to work in that logical, rational way and be sensitive at the same time. And that's really worked fantastically for us. At the same time, we do like nice straightforward projects though.
Oh, I bet you'd love a nice straightforward project, wouldn't you?
And funny enough, we were doing some work on some words with Dean and Co. and Simon, who we've been working with. It was a lovely moment back in sort of September, and he said, I remember doing the branding originally, and, you know, looking at what you've done now, you know, 4 years later, it's exactly what you said you were going to do. And he said, it's really nice to come back to a brand and see how it's evolved and developed, which made doing the new words much easier.
Yeah, because I one of the things I really like is the kind of consistency across projects. I guess that having the same visual style across them all really helps as well. But I think you and Jonathan, from the times that I knew you worked at the last practice, you kind of had a similar eye on things as well. Yeah. When new people come to the practice, I'm curious, when you employ new people, do they come because they like, we want to design more of what you've designed. We've seen your website. We really like those projects. So actually it kind of self cycles, you're getting more people who actually understand what Fathom's about, and then you get the right type of architects, is it well like that?
I think so, probably more now than in the first couple of years. So Adam has been part of the team for a good few years now, came from South Africa. And I think we worked out between us that his background in South Africa, people work in a very different way. And it was really hard, particularly in sort of the town planning element. It's like, I don't understand how this works. It's really grey, and it's kind of really, it's really hard to navigate around. But actually, after sort of 12 months of sort of starting to understand that and doing it a few times, it's kind of, oh yeah, I get this now. And so you've got someone there with a different background and culture, adding something different, but having understood the sort of constraints that we work in here. I think now we do get more people applying. Actually, we just put an advert in last Friday for new people, and there's more there to see. And there's more consistency probably there than what we had on day one. But I always worry we're too broad. You know, we have a huge range of building types. It's ridiculous. But that's because we're not sectorized, because we specialize in, you know, those sort of two areas. And also it's very hard to see that consistency from the inside, isn't it? I think you probably see it more easily than we do.
Well, because I love the graphics. I love the kind of the style of everything. And I was just to give people a sense of scale as well. How many people are Fathom now?
So we're about 10 at the moment, but we scale up and down depending on what's happening. So Laura and Adrian we use depending on how much interior design work we have and laboratory work we have. We have another person with Ben who works in digital environments. So he works between sort of physical space and digital space. Really, really interesting person we started working with about 12 months ago. And then, you kind of come out. So, as you mentioned earlier, we have Atlas who do production information for us. We do detailed design. We think really hard about what the materials are made of, how it comes together, how you keep the water out. And they worry about, what level we're drawing it on, what spec tag we have. And I think it goes back to sort of the 70s and 80s where you'd have a drafting team would do the drafting and the architects would do the other bits. And I think, in all my career, I've always felt creative architects that I've worked with have been not so good at doing production information. It's a different part of the brain. Yeah. And, Atlas do an amazing job at working through that and also, pulling us up on things as well. And obviously that comes back through us, that gets checked. And that as a process that works well. So some days we could be 25.
Yeah.
But 25 people we know and have worked together with almost consistently for probably like 15 years. So it's a well-oiled machine. So the question isn't quite right. And that's sort of the point of that bubble diagram, if you like.
Yeah. And do you guys use Revit? Or I'm just curious. Yeah.
We had a tough call when we set up because we all come from a MicroStation background.
I love MicroStation.
And so what do we do? It's like, we can't not do Revit. And I think we're probably about 12 months too soon for the kind of skill base to be there with architects. So, trying to find people who had any Revit skill was hard work. Let alone our own skills. And then to make it worse, it's like, if we're going to transition, there's no point buying MicroStation licenses. So we
went cold turkey.
So we went AutoCAD first, which was equally painful because, oh my God, I can't even print the file. It's like, as a transition, because you don't want to, you get AutoCAD at that time, you got it free with Revit. So you don't want to buy two sets of extremely expensive licenses to do that. So that's been painful. But I think we're coming out the other end of that really well. Adam, from his background in South Africa, was BIM manager of a practice of 35 people.
Perfect.
The only people we came across in the market who seemed to understand BIM 4 years ago were either South African or Australian.
Yeah.
They seem to be born with BIM. I don't know how that happened.
I totally agree. And also the people who know it really, really well are so infuriatingly fast at using it. You're like, oh, well, they can do that in 5 seconds. So why is it taking me 4 days to do a quarter of what he's done? It drives me mad.
I was very excited, Damon. Harry on our team turned around and said, I think it'd be quicker for me to model it in Revit. And I was like, yes.
It's finally happened. I know we tried to use Revit on a big project, but it was just so cumbersome and slow for us because we don't have a Revit in-house manager or anything. So it's like back to AutoCAD and Rhino. You started off, it sounded very plain sailing. You got a client on the very first day.
Yeah.
Has it, it can't have been plain sailing the entire time. What's been the challenge? Because you're essentially, all the responsibility rests on your shoulders.
I think one of the tricky things we had is being a startup with big building experience. And we'd done a few sort of smaller things as part of that experience. And that was difficult because it's very hard for a client to give you big projects when there's only three or four of you sitting in a room and you've only been going for 2 months.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had one long established client and they were like, you know, when I put you in my QA system, it's just like red lights at every single stage. But we know you and we'll just turn those off, which is really lovely, you know, that those relationships kind of carry through. So it's quite a hard slog in those early stages. But that said, you don't need much to make it work and sort of build up that kind of momentum. But yeah, probably a little bit slower than we would have liked, but...
Well, because you essentially are now, so this one of my questions was, you know, I know that you love designing and things, but when you're now the leader of a practice, so how much design, have you had to like relinquish a lot of that and now you're kind of more management, or how do you balance the kind of love of architecture with actually just having to kind of steer the ship as well?
Yeah, I think it's important if when you're leading a practice compared with working within a practice, even at a senior level within a practice, is to make sure that you can pull back and be strategic. And as a client said to me the other day, it's like, Justin, don't get lost in the weeds. And I was like, okay, that's really good advice.
Yeah.
And it's quite hard to pull back because obviously you're in it every day. So, and, you know, having, you know, partners meetings and things and, you know, having Tom and Jonathan there to kind of bounce those things off becomes really important. We haven't quite got to the stage of using kind of, you know, a lot of people have non-executive directors and things, and we're, you know, we're way too small for that. But I think that's a bit of sounding board from people outside of the practice is really important. And quite often those conversations will happen with other people running businesses that I know or we know. And they're quite surprising because they're completely applicable, whether it's an architect's practice, an M&E engineer's practice, somebody building electric bikes. You know, it's the issues are all the same. And the people running those have probably more in common with you than the people in your practice because they're feeling that same weight, if you like.
And so... I guess, so I'm thinking from my point of view, when you're in a practice, you never think about someone's laying the train tracks ahead and you've got to keep those projects going, you've got to keep the train tracks going because the train's rumbling along. Were you anticipating that, that kind of pressure when you were at Make? Because ultimately, you're in a bigger system and now suddenly it's you have to win these projects, you have to be looking a year ahead or whatever.
I think you do... You know, I did feel it before, particularly when there was, you know, financial crash happened. You know, there's a huge responsibility there to, you know, you're one of those people going out doing that, but you're not the one.
Yeah.
And that's quite a difference. And actually, the first moment I felt, oh, the buck stops here, was when we were doing the branding and sitting in the room and it's like, okay, so Dean and Co, really good branding consultants, work with them, they know us really well. I'm sitting there and going, okay, we've got some really good people around the table. And I think we've got it down to three names. And I deliberately went around each individual sitting there, the graphic designer, the kind of the account manager, the, you know, Joy who runs it, Simon, Patrick, Jonathan, myself, Tom. And I was like, okay, everyone's got a different view. And in my mind, I was like, oh, I've got, it's like, okay, Justin, this is your turn. And it's like, okay, so in theory, I've put, you know, the best people together around the room to make this decision. So if I'm happy with all those people and the process has gone really well, actually the decision probably doesn't matter. Just make one.
Yeah.
And it was weird because you'd think the name is really important, and actually the putting the team together was the important bit of the person leading the business, not necessarily the answer. I was like, okay, we'll go with that one then.
That's a really good, I totally buy into that way of thinking. You're like, hang on, I'm surrounded by really good people. Any of these options is a good option.
Yeah.
So have you managed to maintain a kind of consistent project pipeline, or do you suddenly go, shit, we've got like five massive projects? Do you say no to projects? Do you like just ramp up the team for a couple of months?
It goes up and down all the time.
Yeah.
And when you least expect it, it's amazing. And it goes back to that point right at the beginning of having large project experience. And that it does exasperate that kind of the peaks and troughs. And you've got to up resource, down resource, try and predict. So, in an ideal world, we have a large number of medium-sized projects. what we normally end up with is one or two very large projects and then lots of really, really tiny projects. So that's tricky, but I think that's the same in any business. Nothing's smooth. Everything's quite lumpy. And I think growth is also not this nice sort of smooth curve. It's more like a staircase that kind of goes up and then it goes flat for a bit and then it goes up again. And somewhere about halfway along the tread, everything's hunky-dory.
Yeah.
Which is about once every 6 months.
You're like, do you have this moment? You're like, I need to enjoy this moment because it's only going to last about 3 or 4 days and it doesn't happen very often.
And I think as we mentioned it on a previous podcast, it's like we're really bad at celebrating things because you always think about the next thing that needs sorting out and we're lucky enough we won some work in the first few days of this year. So we've got a home delivery of Hawksmoor steaks coming in a week or two's time. We can find a delivery slot from them because it's like if you don't celebrate it now, it will turn into bad news at some point.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's the thing. So once you build a company, people come to you that this is their career. They take it really seriously. Like you have to be thinking, what do people benefit by being here? Not there's the environment. I mean, we're in your new office. What, newish? You've been here for a couple of years, you say?
Yeah, 3 years, I think, coming up.
But it's lovely. It's really nice. I think having a nice office space makes a huge difference. And I think post-COVID, which I thought I could say now, but I can't.
Oh, yeah.
The post-redo. Getting people to come in, they need to feel like they're getting something back, right? So I think like office culture, is that something that's kind of key to you as well?
Yeah, and it's really important to get the right mix of people, the space, but also to make sure everyone's properly contributing and are part of that decision-making process and part of that design process. It's not just, this is not just, okay, go away and draw this up. It's like, you've had 7-9 years of training. You're actually quite good at this at that point. So your creative input is really important as part of that. And then, making sure the office environment, we really love it. We've got an old converted Victorian school. So we've got, sort of double height space. We've got north light, we've got through ventilation, we've got nice bricks. I think it's actually been a really good break for us over the odd times that we've been able to come into the studio over the last 12 months. It's been, I've certainly found it a really good kind of respite from lockdown and so forth. And I think quite a few of the team have found that quite helpful. So.
Oh yeah. I mean, we were saying before we started recording that, having kids in the house, you're like, oh damn, I've got to go into the office. I would love to go into the office. But it's like, you said at the beginning, you had this plan of like, I want an office, I want it near London Bridge, and now you're here. Do you have like another five, 10-year goal? I mean, what is success? Is it like, is there a certain size? Is there a certain scale of project? Like, what is it that kind of focuses you?
So scale of practice is a really interesting question. And a lot of people, I think, ask that question on the basis of, how much income do you want to have, how many people do you want to have around? And actually,
more is better.
And I feel it's different to that. I think it's actually about scale of project. And I think, there's a sort of sweet spot of project that, let's say, Alex, we really enjoy doing the sort of, 20 to 60, 70 million pound scheme. It's where our skill base is, but that's small enough to still move relatively
small
speedily.
I love it, 70 million.
But it's not a you know, £200 million project that's going to last 5 or 10 years. And if you marry that with small projects that, you know, in our world is kind of like, you know, 1 to 5 million, say, which are much, much quicker, that's actually really interesting for people because you can go start to finish within 12 months potentially on some of them. That's really good for part three. It's really good for learning. You get, you know, rather than being stuck on a reflective ceiling plan for 2 years over 40 stories, you're in and out. You've done every single bit of a project. You know, we've got a few heritage buildings that are on site at the moment. And, you know, you're flipping from doing loos to toilets to front doors to tiling to paint finishes all within the same meeting. And that's really nice in a small kind of compact team. So to do that sweet spot of project, you then want to work out, okay, really I need 4, 5, 6, 10 of those so that when one stops, you can absorb that team into the other projects rather than being a massive cliff face. So it gives you much more stability in your income stream rather than having 150 million pound project that if it stops means you've got to lose, you know, half the practice.
Yeah. So actually the number of people comes down to resilience as much as, you know, if, for example, if I could guarantee you the three perfect projects that you could have every year and that would never change, would you stick at this size or do you think bigger? Because I guess you get quite, you have a handle on a lot of projects, you see a lot, whereas the bigger the scale, I guess ultimately you have to kind of diverse responsibility.
Yeah, I think given the size of projects, I think we need to be a bit bigger to make it less kind of lumpy. One of a better word. And you can't just isolate one of those things. You know, it's unrealistic to say, okay, you know, forgetting the lumpiness of the income, what would your dream be? Because actually running a business is about balancing all those different things. And I think that's probably the biggest message, if you like, is actually you can't just be idealistic about one thing that turns into a really nice brand. You've got to balance that against everything else. And ultimately, you know, you have to pay people's rent and mortgage and salaries at the end of every month. So, you know, it's balancing that.
So do you think, do you have it like another five-year aspiration, like to double, triple in size or?
Well, our five-year anniversary is coming up on the 4th of May this year. So
nice.
It's our task between now and then to sort of sit down and kind of flush out what that looks like. So hopefully the pandemic might be behind us at some point.
God, I hope so.
We've hopefully got a few more wrinkles to iron out in Brexit. But I think now we're starting to, you know, we've got some projects. We've got two or three projects finishing soon. We've got a fantastic project that we finished. We PC'd a week before lockdown and photographed the day before lockdown that's ready to be launched, but it's still sitting there 9 months later. It's such a shame. And you know, those moments are really fantastic. You know, you've built something, and I love building things. My father was a builder. I get a huge amount of excitement about that lovely smell of like concrete and timber when you walk past the building site. It's like, oh yes, that's what we're here to do. So getting something out at the other end of that is really critical. And I think will really help us grow as a business. And then there's obviously a lot of projects on the website that hopefully demonstrate our you know, sensibility and technical capability.
Yeah, because it's interesting you say the smell of a construction site and things. When I was on Broadgate, you know, you're in a site office for so long, too long. But there is something incredibly, like there's something exciting about being on a construction site. It's kind of slightly manic, slightly chaotic. There's an intensity to it. I think actually, like, you've got quite an appealing job description for a new architect, right? You know, because there's something like the bigger practice, you know, like other practices that we won't name. You know, you might work on projects for 5 years and never build anything. You know, that's happened to me.
Or, you know, hats off to the master planners, because they work on stuff for years and years and years, and then, you know, someone else builds it, if you're lucky. So, you know, I have a huge amount of respect for people who are able to work on that. You know, it's a very different plane of thinking, I think, and output, if you wish.
So I guess, we're coming to time now, so I'll end on this question, but are there kind of trends or technologies or directions of architecture that you're like, oh, we should go after that? You know, are you looking ahead to things that excite you as collectively an office you're all fascinated by? AI or VR or something. Did you have those things?
I can't remember one conversation we haven't had in the last 9 months about the future of anything. Future of the workplace, future of the high street, future of residential, you know, and that what's been fantastic about the last 9 months is it's really helped us question that. And I think it's increased the rate of change in an industry that is generally not known for its pace of change because of that risk element. And I think we had to do that. So, you know, suddenly everybody's flexibly working and everyone's working from home. People have been doing that for years, but just not very many.
Yeah.
So I think that's actually been really positive. The high street, sadly, has been dying for years since the internet's come in. And I think that will really help us get over that industrial inertia of instead of going, oh, I've got all these empty shots, what do I put in them? It's going the other way around. It's like, okay, we did a piece of work on the future of the high street this time last year, even pre-pandemic, actually. It's like, well, let's stop talking about real estate. Let's talk about shopping and the internet. And then let's think about what a physical manifestation of that would look like, which is where Ben kind of came in. And that's really, really fascinating. And now that's completely, you know, it was much more relevant than when we looked at it 12 months ago. So those are good.
Just sticking on that, is that born out of a kind of, we're doing similar things, and I think it's born out of knowing the right type of clients who, not that it's not impacting us all as well, but a lot of our clients happen to be like, honestly, what do we do with all this retail space? And also, not mentioning names, people who we know are working on big projects near Oxford Street, suddenly the bottom's just fallen out of retail, and that, now the kind of the development models don't stack up. So suddenly everyone's like, what do we do with retail? Is it because you think a lot of it's an answer to some clients' questions?
Yeah, every client's different. And, you know, if you're talking to a client whose core business is tech,
that's
very different. If you're talking to a client whose core business is estate management, it's huge. They really shouldn't be that different, but they are because they have different business drivers. So I think, you know, you have to do it on a project by project basis, but sometimes it's good to sort of pull back. So we've got this lovely project down in Woking, which is Christchurch Woking, which is a lovely Victorian listed church right in the centre of Woking Towns. And it's right on the high street. It's opposite Paper Chase and Starbucks. It's not even set back a metre from the high street. And they run a lovely cafe. They've been doing it for years, a bookshop and a kind of conference suite. And, you know, they came to us, said, you know, we're thriving, we want to expand. This was about 2 or 3 years ago. We won the job in a competition. And we were sitting here over this year talking about the future of the high street. And I was like, hang on, we've already done it. It's Christchurch Woking. And we've got this, you know, lovely expanded cafe that we've now got planning consent for, a bookshop. And it's like, if you cover up the rest of the project and just look at the ground floor, they're all shop fronts, but it's a church. And if you think about what the high street was about, it was about community. And if you think about what a church was about, it was about community. And they're the sort of the same thing. So I think that conversation is very much about use and creating places, not just creating shops, which is a kind of monoculture of leisure-based retail. And I think that's the thing that we've got to get our head around really quickly, in order to kind of make that work. I think that then leads to all sorts of questions about how do you rentalize space when your shop is taking more income from its website because it's got a retail presence on a high street. So the rental model is got to be completely turned upside down. So there's so many other manifestations before we get down to what should a shop look like.
Yeah.
There's a really interesting company worth having a look at if you're interested in retail. It's called Souk.
So I was just about to say that.
S-O-O-K. I went past their unit on Oxford Street. I think they've got a second one opening in London soon. They've got one in Cambridge, one opening in Edinburgh, where you rent the shop by the hour. And it's like, oh my God, that's genius, because, you know, most retailers, high street retailers, operate kind of, you know, sort of Friday to Sunday is their core area of sales. And the rest of the week, they don't really do a huge amount. So you flip it over and go, okay, well, it can be a yoga studio. for a number of days, and you've got digital wallpapers, it's called, lining the units. You can brand it, you can bring your stuff in, move it around. So I think, you know, some really interesting things going on in that space.
I spoke to their like head of advertising. I was doing an esports talk, and he was like, all right, because I was talking about like digital infrastructure, and he was saying, oh yeah, you can have like a Instagram person who sells bespoke sneakers, trainers or whatever, and just for one day in a month he can just hire it out for one evening and have, because they've got massive screens, make it look incredible. And that's all he has to have. And I was like, yeah, that's like tripling the amount of uses you can get in a single day. I thought it was really interesting.
And I, you know, and the other part of your question there was about tech, and I think I'm slightly geeky in my subscription to The New Scientist. I'm struggling to find an article that I've not read in the last 6 months in The New Scientist that hasn't mentioned AI.
Yeah.
You know, DeepMind is a really fascinating, you know, if you walk around King's Cross, they're everywhere. If you look at the implications of that in medical science, it's huge. We did some work on a scheme down in Bletchley and looking at, you know, where the future needs are, and things like quantum computing are real. And it's like, I still can't get my head out. I don't really understand what it is. But I think the general premise is that traditional computing is running out of power and we need to flip to a different model of computing. So people want to build these things, they want to test them. And that's equally important to something like medical science as it is to gaming or the film industry, as it is to, you know, running a business. So you think about those kind of Microsoft apps or client management systems and things, websites, cookies, all that. That whole world. And I think we need to really think carefully about the ethical use of data and the processing opportunities that offers. And I think it's a really, really interesting time. And, you know, the work we've done with the medical scientists in Oxford over the years, one of the things that I've really learned from that is that they do spend as much time thinking about the ethics of something they're doing as the actual science. And I think that's the bit that maybe doesn't come across with the big tech companies.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess the tech companies just, they operate at such a pace. They just don't stop and think. Well, I'm sure they do. And then they work out, can they get sued for it? And they go, no.
Well, yeah, you know, but we've also got to remember that they've delivered an amazing rate of change and innovation in the last, you know, probably even 10 years. You know, mobile smartphones and mobile data has totally transformed our life. We have a very different COVID lockdown if it wasn't for that. So it is balancing the huge positives that come with that with the kind of negatives that we see in the press. And I think, you know, it's an interesting one, and I think it's a fantastic space to be thinking about.
So, because, yeah, I think, yeah, imagine a COVID 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Jesus. Landlines everywhere.
Yeah. Or dial-up internet, you know. Remember that.
God. Well, we're going to wrap it up there. And I just want to say thank you. And I absolutely love your office space. And you should go on the Fathom website because there's some really, really lovely projects, especially the Christchurch expansion. Is that being built?
We've got planning. So, yeah, they're looking after their members at the moment. Obviously through COVID, that's quite tough. So we hope that goes forward soon.
Oh, I love that scheme. Right. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for coming in. I hope that was interesting.
That really was. Thank you. There you go. That was Justin Nichols, the co-founder of Fathom Architects. I hope you really enjoyed that. It was just great to go to his studio and to kind of chat to him in person, obviously before all this kicked off, all this lockdown shenanigans kicked off in January. But this is one of the things I love about doing the podcast. You get to go to the studios. It's great. So thank you so much to Justin. And they've got loads of really, really cool projects in the pipeline and loads that they've done. And they just keep pushing out really interesting stuff. So thank you so much for listening. The next episode is with David Illingworth, who is the co-founder of London Structures Lab, who are an innovative new structural engineering company in London. So we talk about loads of stuff. So that's really fun. So click subscribe if you enjoyed that. You can find more podcasts on our website at www.createmorepodcasts.com, or you can find us at Instagram at createmorepodcasts. So thank you so much for listening and tune in next week. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.